Well, this is related to our East Carolina University football team. Off to a quick start, and now we're in slow mode. Pick number 14, and then number 15, and then number 24, and now we're even out of the top 25. So, what I want to do today is Jim just told you was a nice segue to this, because we've got 12 years of mark recapture data, and from commercial fishermen all over the East Coast, appreciate it, and some sport fishermen as well. And so we want to show you the results of some of that information. The reason we're all here, of course, is because of the end product. You know, and tawny dogfish is not just the East Coast of the United States, but it's worldwide. And so these are some of the different names that it's known by around the world. Here's the product. You know, we've got those stiff ones that Jim was showing in the lab. The ones that are shipped overseas, I suppose, are the ones that are cut for belly flaps, the ones that have the nice broad backs. This is from a processor on the West Coast. So this afternoon, what I want to do is kind of give you an outline of where I'm going here, give a little bit of background on how East Carolina University got started with tawny dogfish, and the objective of our studies and some of the databases that we're using, give you some of the results we have to date, and give you some perspective on where we're going in the next couple of years with our research. In North Carolina, it just seemed like we kept getting regulated right out of business. You know, the flounder was highly regulated, and the bluefish were highly regulated, and everything's being highly regulated. And so we were encouraged to use underutilized species, and dogfish was one of those. So folks like Dewey over here, who's one of my co-investigators, started working with tawny dogfish in the early and mid-1990s. And by 1994, two commercial fishermen came to me, Eddie Newman from Englehart, North Carolina, and Chris Hickman from Havas Village, and they were very concerned about the number of boats that were coming down from other states besides North Carolina and participating in the tawny dogfish fishery. And they came to me and they said, can we determine how many boats we can have in order to sustain this fishery? And I said, yeah, I think we can do that. So about the time we actually got geared up and started working on it, the whole thing collapsed. But we seem now to be in a rebuilding period faster than anticipated, but yet we're not seeing most recruits coming behind. And so we've come to the conclusion that we don't really know a whole lot about tawny dogfish and their life history and their movements and migration on the East Coast. So we started our work in 1996, and we continue it today, and we've got some grants going for the next 2 years. Most all of our work involves the commercial fishermen. So we're working with commercial fishing industry, and most recently with Dewey Helmreich right here, and trying to answer some of the questions that are really plaguing us from North Carolina. We also have a work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and with the National Marine Fisheries Service in a winter cooperative winter tagging cruise, and so you'll see some of that data here in a minute. We've tagged over 38,000 fish since 1996, and I urge you, if you know of anybody that has these tags, to please turn them in, because you'll see it's very, very important for us to be able to answer some of these questions and maybe shed some better light on the end product of the management aspect of this whole issue. So first of all, I wanted to show you some of the results of our tagging studies. We're using a single barb dart tag. We've used several over the years. We've used a real short one. We've used a longer one, both of which were international orange. They no longer make that, so we've gone to a stainless steel insert single barb dart. It's yellow. And then it says return for reward. It gets an address, and it gets a website, www.spawnydogfish.org. So if you go there, this is what you'll see. And we're using this as a launch vehicle for our Spawny Dogfish Research Network. So if you are into anything to do with dogfish, you'd like to know more about it and so forth, we urge you to join the Spawny Dogfish Research Network. This is trying to pull a lot of different researchers together so we don't end up duplicating efforts and wasting a lot of extra money. You know, let's pull all together, go forward in one single unit, try to answer some of these questions. On this website, you'll see a tag return form. We just ask you for the tag number, the date of the capture, a verbal description of where it was caught, and then a latitude and longitude, or a LORAN, if you have it. The capture method, what depth, what the water temperatures were, air temperature, anything else, you know, was it raining outside, windy day, whatever. And then if you can, note the sex and the total length of the fork length. When we measure total length, we pull the fish all the way out, stretch it all the way out in order to get that total length. And then we ask for your name, address, and telephone number. And in return, I'll send you a letter, handwritten by me and hand-signed by me, at my home, written on my personal checks, that say when and where it was caught, and I'll give you $10 or $50, depending on what the value of the tag is. We're going to use some GIS, spatial analysis, in order to analyze some of these data. We've done some time series work. We've looked at mean directional movements, and we've done some zonal statistical analysis, basically looking at the symmetry of where the dogfish was caught. And I'll show you those in just a second. So these are some of the major questions that we're interested in. Where's the high intensity recapture area for the fishery? I can tell you right now it's Massachusetts. What's the migration extent of dogfish tagged in North Carolina waters? You know, do they go south of Cape Hatteras, and if so, how many? Do they move into Canadian waters, and if so, what's the percentage? And do they move off the continental slope, or off the shelf down into the continental slope? And then we're in North Carolina, we're particularly interested in how long do dogfish stay in the overwintering habitats, or do they just come and go very quickly? As I said before, we've tagged over 38,000 fish. We've gotten 340 tag returns. Actually, it's a little higher than that now, but that's almost 1%. It's not very good, but that's at the same rate as they get that Steve Campana gets for his Canadian fish that are tagged and released and recaptured. We have some similar problems to Jim in that some of the recaptures are on land, and the latitudes, longitudes, or LORAN coordinates don't exactly match up with the maps. So in some cases, we have fishermen that capture a fish in one area and then land it in another. But here's an overview of what we have so far. We did do some tagging in Canada. We've gotten 36 tag returns from those that were in Canada, or Eastern Canada. And you see that most of them are recaptured in Canada. So 15 out of the 36 total were listed as being from Canada. Unfortunately, there were 17 that had no return address. So, it makes it very difficult. So if all possible, it's really, really important for you to tell us where you caught these fish. But we've also tagged about 38,000 fish in the United States, in off of North Carolina in specifically. And you can see that the number one state here for returns is Massachusetts. Followed by New Jersey. Look at there, Peter. Well, here's North Carolina, 84, but that's where they were released. But most of those were not caught in the same season. Most of those were caught a year, 2 years, 5 years later. You know, something else that's really interesting is that sometimes I get back tag returns from almost the very spot where I released it. Almost a year to the day later, 2 years to the day later. So there must be something going on there where they have there's a time clock in there somehow, and a map and a calendar, and they're able to go to that one special spot. I've seen that with striped bass as well. So what I'm going to show you now is a little time series analysis, and watch your particular state. Here's where we tagged off of North Carolina. We also tagged a little bit in Canada, but I'm going to show you the progression up and down the eastern seaboard over time. So here's just 2 weeks after release. There's a month, 2 months. We're starting to get into early June. There's during the summer, early summer, midsummer. But now look at the spread. You would think that they'd all be up in Massachusetts, but they're not. And during the early part of this study, in the mid-90s, we saw a real clear progression all the way up to Massachusetts and back. I used to go up there to summer holiday, go to the music tents and whatever, you know, they'd hunt Cape Cod. And then they come back down here to overwinter off the Outer Banks, where it's real cold and windy and they can't get at them very easy. But they're really spread out here. Okay, and here's later on in the season, and then 160 days at large, August maybe. So no longer are we seeing this real clear migration pattern, and that's going to be real important in here just a little bit when I talk more, show more about the how the data spread out. But here's January 1st, December 31st is out here, and the light gray boxes would indicate when we would suspect that spiny dogfish should be in North Carolina waters overwintering. But you can see that right after release, there are some that are going up quite high, maybe in New Jersey, Peter, and then up here in Massachusetts, some even up into Bay of Fundy area and up into Nova Scotia. So it's not no longer the clear pattern that it once was. If we look at directionality of movement, we can see that for 0 to 15 days, they might mill around a little bit right in this general area. But by 60 to 105 days after release and subsequent recapture, they're making a pretty clear beeline for the northern climes. They're going up along the state, the various states towards Massachusetts and the Bay of Fundy. And here we're just putting it on a map to show the relative directions. How many of these fish move south of Cape Hatteras? Well, you know, we get a substantial number. We tagged in January during the CMAP cruises, and then the commercial fishermen and I tag in February and even in March. But the area of tagging is right along in here primarily. And so these fish that occurred on here may be those early ones that are continuing to migrate down and around Cape Hatteras and go down into the bight of the Hatteras bite right there. How many of these fish move into Canadian waters? Jim Fletcher, you mentioned 10% earlier, but you know this is the data they're getting it from. 7% is what we've gotten so far. 7% of all the fish tagged in North Carolina were caught in Canadian waters. So do dogfish cross a 100-fathom contour? Well, we have three tag returns from over 100 fathoms, but you know the real problem here is that a lot of fishermen don't go out that far, especially our commercial fishermen in the wintertime aren't going out that far. So so most of our tag returns are coming up along the coastline here. You can see off of Cape Cod here the tremendous number that we're getting up in here. I don't know what you call this area, but it's around Boston limits. Would you say Marshfield area? You know, that's where we're getting a lot of them. So they're up close to the shoreline there. Now, Jennifer Cudney was working with the GIS spatial analysis. Both Jennifer and Gary Wright are in the back of the room, and if you get a chance, you should say hi to them. They're graduate students working on these problems in my lab. But anyway, you can see more clearly where these recaptures are coming from. The Sail Wagon Bank is out here someplace. Where are you up in? Is this it right here? Right there? Okay. So anyway, we can get the bathymetry from maps like this. We can drill down through the map and determine the depth. And you can see that most of our recaptures are coming within in areas that are 25 meters or less in depth. So 75 feet, 80 feet max. Over half the recaptures, and a quarter of them are coming within 30 feet of depth. So they're real close to shore, basically. And I don't know what's the albatross able to do? How shallow can they sample? 30 feet. So, you know, a quarter of our of our recaptures may be coming from areas that the Albatross might not be able to get into. So, anyway, that's a thought. You know, the marked recaptures don't tell you the types of things that Jim's satellite tags. We just get a start point and we just get an end point. We don't know where they've been in between. Sometimes we've had fish out 4 and 5 years before they return. The longer they're out, the more valuable they become. And we can get measurements on length, you know, all kinds of things. So it becomes really, really important to get that data back to me. But sometimes people are reluctant to turn these things in because they're afraid it's going to result in worse management for the species. And I assure you that we have nothing to do with the management aspect, but we're trying to understand the science so we can pass the science along to people like Paul so they can model that and get better models for you. I'm going to show you a new paradigm now, with a hypothetical paradigm that we're pushing. Different from that from the National Fisheries Service, and this is based on my study of 38,000 tags, 340 returns, a tagging study we did in Nova Scotia in the 1990s, using 1,100 tags and 17 returns, and then Steve Campana and all the work that's been done up there, including a tagging study that we did in 2005 and 2006. And here it is. Here's the migratory path between Cape Cod and North Carolina. It's seasonal. They end up here in the summer. They end up here in the winter. There appears to be a second subgroup that are making a pass in this direction. There's a third subgroup that tend to move onshore and offshore of Nova Scotia. And then the fourth and fifth subgroups are vestigial populations. Yes, it's a one-time stocking effort, but maybe there was a Gulf Stream gyre or something that went up in here and had a bunch of fish. But there's no new recruits to that population. It's not a breeding population. It's slowly declining in size. So this is based upon some of Paul's data and how they move along in here, plus the Campanas, plus mine, and some earlier tagging studies. And we're hoping that we can show better, or get some more data that would show that this is the correct model. So our tagging data then is showing that there is this mid-Atlantic movement up and down the coast. And we can use some of this data to challenge some of the current camping efforts, and they still have an extent of the range, which is a big concern in North Carolina. The question that we have then is, are dogfish effectively sampled off of North Carolina? Here are a lot of our tag returns, or all of our tag returns to date. We've had one there, must be in Elizabeth City. But we didn't take that one out, we left it. But anyway, you can see that this is the 100-foot contour, and a lot of our, most of our tag returns are coming within 100 feet. Here is the 40-foot contour, and we're still getting some within 40 feet. And then, of course, all these below here in the Hatteras Bight, that may not be sampled effectively by the next spring fall survey. Now I want to talk a little bit about whether or not we think that striped bass overwintering in North Carolina waters is affecting other species. And this is something that's been addressed several times. David, you've said, yeah, I think cod are being affected, and there seems to be some kind of synergy between cod and dogfish in your data. And I'm using striped bass as an example here. So we're wondering if some of the declining striped bass catches in this annual CMAP cruise taken in January is corresponding to some increased funny dogfish catches. And then we're speculating that perhaps there's some synergy going on there. Either the dogfish are driving the fish, the striped bass, off of their primary overwintering grounds into secondary overwintering grounds, or maybe they're just coexisting in relative abundance. Now, I have to put some caveats in the data I'm going to show you. The first thing is that this cooperative winter tagging cruise is specifically designed to tag striped bass. So you have to understand that. That's the data set that I'm working with. And what I'm doing is I'm taking the striped bass catches out of these trawls, and then I'm looking at the subsequent coexisting catch of dogfish that's in that same trawl and comparing those. Not all data is available for all years. We're working on that right now. And so there were some environmental variables that were corrupted in my data set, and so I'm not going to show that today, but in any kind of tabular format. Here is the fall and spring stations from lower Chesapeake Bay all the way down to North Carolina from 1968 to 2006. So this is the Northeast Fishery Science Center data Paul provided for me. And here is the CMAF Cooperative Winter Tagging Cruise for 1996 to 2008. So you can see right away that we are squeezed right up along the coastline. We're not going way out like Paul's survey does way out here. And if you were to overlap them, that's what this looks like. So I'm going to pick an early and a late period. So I got involved in 1996, and so I'm going to take the data from 1997 to 1999 from this cooperative winter tagging cruise and compare it to the years 2006 to 2008. The two sampling platforms are the Oregon 2, which is out of Pascagoula, and the Albatross, which has been used on a rare occasion when the Oregon 2 wasn't available. Sometimes maybe commercial fishermen think this is how scientists think. You know, we look at a lot of seagulls, and we, you know, have we look at things that are on the boat as thingies rather than as a real name. You know, I don't even know what the name of that thing is. I know it's the type of boat up with, okay? But this, when we get a lot of dogfish, a lot of striped bass, this is what we look like on the back of the deck. We've got a wrangler here. We've got two seawater tanks going, trying to keep the fish alive. We've got these guys are picking up dogfish off the decks, and then there's another wrangler here that slides them on here. There's a tagger that gets the length that sticks in the tag, and this person gives the tag to this person and records the data, and then it's thrown overboard. So it's a real fast, efficient operation. Sometimes, though, we have to stop because we catch things like this. I'm sure some of you guys have seen these things in North Carolina waters. That was a real famous photograph, by the way. It's one I took, and then the bomb squad had to come out from Cherry Point and take it up to Norfolk and blow it up. Okay, well, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to show you a sequence of pictures here to show you where dogfish, or striped bass on this side, and dogfish on this side are located, and show you that there's some coexistence in abundance along this continuum right here. Okay? So let's look at 1997. In 1997, there was an average of 129 striped bass per square kilometer and 148 dogfish per square kilometer in the survey, and the dogfish to striped bass ratio was almost 1-to-1. You can see that they don't really coexist up here in any great numbers, but down here there is some overlap. Okay, that's 1997. And here's what the water temperatures look like in 1997. These are sea surface temperatures, and we can see there was a coexistence of striped bass and flying dogfish here. There was a blip of dogfish down here, smaller blip. And then the primary striped bass were up in here. In 1998, the ratio of dogfish to striped bass was 2-to-1, so it's about the same. We see a small contingent of striped bass associated with this large contingent of dogfish. And we see a small contingent of dogfish associated with this large contingent of striped bass. But they don't overlap tremendously, and here's a small contingent of dogfish with no contingent of striped bass. and here's the sea surface temperatures. Again, we saw even sea very much down here because it was too warm. We saw more of them up here because it was cooler water. And in 1999, again, the dogfish to striped bass ratio was about 1:1. And we see an offset, like a slight offset, of the two species right here. And here's the water temperatures in 1999. Way too warm down along here. All right, now let's go to 2006, 2007, and 2008. Look at the huge difference in scale now of dogfish compared to, and then pretty good sizes of striped bass as well. Here's 2006. We're now up to 2,500 dogfish per square kilometer there, and 1,000 striped bass per kilometer here, and a dogfish to striped bass ratio of 2:1. They're pretty well concentrated together. See that? And now if you look at where the water temperatures were, it was too warm. It was forcing everything up here, and so they're all coexisting right along this continuum. In 2007, we have 3,900 dogfish per square kilometer as opposed to 139 striped bass, a 28:1 ratio of dogfish to striped bass. So there's a coexisting aggregation of both species, but this one's a very strong one, this one's very weak, and then they coexist up here off Chesapeake Bay. Again, here's the water patterns for that year. And then in 2008, we get the coexisting of the two species. This is a weak one. This is a strong aggregation, and then off of Chesapeake Bay is fairly strong for both species. So what am I saying here? I think what we're seeing is that before, striped bass and flying dogfish kind of separated themselves. Okay, early in the process here, where spiny dogfish weren't nearly as abundant, striped bass were fully recovered by the National Fisheries Service, and now 10 years later, we're seeing this shift that perhaps you're seeing also, and that is that they're coexisting now where they could separate themselves out before. There may be so many dogfish out there that they're just overlapping on top of one another. So we want to know, are these density estimates realistic? How does spiny dogfish aggregations interact with other species? I think we've shown that. And did we demonstrate that the magnitude of spiny dogfish has an impact on preferred habitats of other species? Well, in 2006, we did a pretty cool experiment on Dewey's vessel. We sampled 255 stations, is that right? Something like that, 255 stations in 1 mile parallel lines at like 1.5 and 2.5 miles offshore, parallel lines and at 1 mile intervals. And so we could do this by taking a dip of a 50-yard net, and it was 25 meters of 5-inch.
5.5 and 25 of 4.5, about 25 meters deep.
So we put that out for 10 minutes, pulled it in, and zoomed to the next station. We could do this in 20 minutes. So every 20 minutes we were sampling 1 mile down the beach, okay? 255 times up here. And we did a similar thing down here. And this is the results that we got. Now, one problem with this is that we don't know how well gill nets tell us what the density of dogfish are. Okay, that's not been calibrated, and we're going to do that. I don't know if it's going to be this winter or next winter. We're going to calibrate these gill nets. But this is the linear distance of influence from the gill net, and what we're saying is we're assuming that all dogfish 45 meters from the gill net is being caught. Now, we all know that's probably not the case. But let's assume that, okay? Here was our total dogfish catch. This was the total survey area. And this is the number of units that we sampled in the survey area. And the total population size that we estimated, if you assume that we caught 100% of the fish within 45 meters of those nets, we say there was 173 million dogfish. And if we say that this was the total weight at 6 pounds, and there were four, we're saying the total population size for this time period, which was very short, just a few days, the total population size in metric tons was 473 million metric tons. That's a lot. But is it reasonable? I mean, here, over here, we're saying we caught everything within 9 meters, and that's 2.3 billion metric tons. I think that's a little over-optimistic. Over here, we're saying it was within almost 100 meters of influence, caught everything within 100 meters, and that puts it down to only 94,000 metric tons. I think that's a little low. So the answer is probably somewhere in here. But let's just pick this one. 45 meters, and we'll get a better handle on this winter. 473 million metric tons, okay? Well, that's all spiny dogfish, okay? That's all of them. That's not just females. It's males and females, and we used an area density method. That means that we know the area that we sampled, and we know the concentration in that quadrant, and then we kept moving it all over, and then we just multiplied it out, and that's the number we got. Okay, we also at the same time tagged and released fish and recaptured them. And so we got a population estimate then based upon a model known as Schnabel Mark recapture method. And then we calculated the biomass of mature females greater than 80 centimeters in the same area. And that comes out to be 85,000 metric tons, or 63% of the National Fisheries Service 2006 estimate for mature females. So we're in at least we're in the same ballpark as Paul's model. Okay, that's great. That's great. We're using two entirely different methods, and we're coming up with them in the same ballpark as the National Fisheries Service. Now, if we can get our estimates a little bit better and calibrate those gill nets, we can use this type of estimation then to look at large aggregations of spiny dogfish. So it's really great. But so we only estimated 63% of Paul's estimate. Where are the other 37%? Well, maybe the other 37% were offshore 3 miles, because this was just the inshore, okay? So that seems reasonable. Maybe we're missing 37% of the total. Or perhaps they are north of North Carolina Virginia border. That makes sense too. 37% are still hanging off of Massachusetts. Okay? So I don't think this is an unreasonable estimator. In speaking about bycatch, you know, we went from Cape Hatteras to South Carolina line, and we did a whole bunch of dips from there all the way down, and we got 87% of all the captured fish and gill nets as spiny dogfish. We hardly got any bycatch, and so that just says that these are really schooling in high density packs. So what's up now? We want to do some tagging in New England. It might happen this fall yet. It might be next summer. We were going to start up an acoustic tagging project this winter off the coast. In fact, we'll go back down there in November. We'll put a listening fence out in the Hatteras Bight, and we'll have a set 12 sampling stations. So again, we're working with Dewey and Chris Hickman, and we're going to be listening for those acoustic tagged fish that are going up and down the coast. And, I need to acknowledge a lot of folks, but Sea Grant North Carolina has put out the lion's share of this money. And they work with the commercial fishermen pretty hard, so we're real thankful to them. And I'll take questions. Yeah?
Where does the majority of your recaptures come from? A particular gear, a particular recreational commercial, the mine.
Okay. It used to be almost all commercial. Now it's flipped to a lot of it's recreational. And I would say that that's coming from shoreline fishing. Shoreline fishing, some from that are in boats, and recreationally fishing, like striped bass primarily, I think. That's what they say. You know, I was fishing for striped bass, and I caught this damn boat fish.
Yes. And again, the length of a gillnet?
We're using 50 yards.
50 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you got to take them. Sometimes there was current, and maybe, you know, you feel that much, I mean, that's probably, you know, maybe only 40 yards of fishing or 35 yards of fishing, or less. So, it was pretty neat to do all that and see dogfish all
over. What was our biggest catch, Dewey, in 10 minutes?
It's like 100 and maybe 50 some fish off the Hatters right on the beach, 3/4 of a mile. Like there in the sand and off the village of Hatters.
Yeah. So, yeah, not much for 10, I mean, that's a lot for 10 minutes, yeah.
No, we were just throwing the buoy 10 minutes, running the net out, and getting on it. And you know, in some days we it's over a period of about 12 days or something, some days we've gone 30-some miles of, like third, almost 25 stations or something, just sitting 10 minutes, hauling up, going, and it was all, you know, just doing, staying on a track, not just, you know, every mile, just throwing your net over and continuing on like that.
Mm-hmm. This is the most intense data set I'm aware of. It's pretty amazing. Yeah. Did you have another question? Yeah. Jen?
The reason I laugh while we're going on apologize is in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, where only 5 are, and you're saying that there's no reproduction. The reason there's no reproduction is known to be the chemicals that come out of the St. Lawrence Seaway. So rather than scientifically looking for an explanation, it got just that reproduction didn't happen.
You know, that would be something to address to Steve Cantana with DFO. I don't know anything about the chemistry of St. Lawrence Seaway waters. Any more questions? Jim?
I got a couple of questions. So, your newest data, how do you feel it sort of changed your ultimate, your first against the office of the North South Coast?
I think that there is still this movement, this large-scale movement, because we don't see them hardly at all in the summertime. But I think what's going on in my own mind is that there are so many dogfish now, for whatever reason, maybe they're all up on the beach, and maybe the total numbers hasn't changed, but maybe they're just all packed up on the beach for whatever reason, that they may be moving into secondary habitats. Another explanation would be that environmental conditions have changed off of New England such that they no longer feel the need to migrate south for the winter. Just like Paul was alluding to with the with some of the birds and you know, staying on the golf courses in the wintertime instead of moving farther south. That's a very distinct possibility. One thing I need to say to everybody is, you know, we often think about this population doing this, you know, it's moving in entirety up and down the coast, and that's not true. It's made up, it's just like this room is made up of individuals. And so some of us may have to go out to use the bathroom or to have a coffee break or smoke or something like that. And so there's always individuals moving in and out of this population. And I think that's what Jim has showed with his data, is that there's a lot of individualism in these fish. And we can talk about these general paradigms of things happening, but the fact of the matter is when you get down to the individual level, there's going to be a lot of variability. So it's a matter of of saying, well, what's the right answer? And the right answer is probably, in general, you're going to see these fish moving in some kind of a large-scale pattern, just like a flock of birds migrating south for the winter time, but yet a number of individuals can be left behind in smaller aggregations. Well, that's an excellent question, and that's one that I don't know how we can get a handle on it. But in North Carolina, you know, fishermen will say, you know, that they're eating up all the fish, and we don't catch anything else except for bogfish. Well, did they eat everything that they where they were, or did they drive it away? Here comes a pack of wolves. The deer don't just sit there and get munched on. No, they run away. So I would think that all the prey species would take off and move to less desirable habitats, and then the spiny dogfish would show up and it was there. I don't know what the answer is, and I don't know how you get a handle on that. Yeah.
One thing that maybe you just didn't register when you were going through it, did you type primarily females, a mixture of males?
It's a mixture, okay. And it was all sizes. So some of the smallest ones we tagged were in the 60 to 70 centimeter range. We did tag a few that were over 100, but the fact of the matter is the majority of them were like 80 to 90 centimeters. 70 to 90 centimeters were the majority of the ones we tagged. So some of them really weren't available for the fishery, and so that may be a big part of why we haven't gotten good tag returns on those. But we decided early on that we weren't going to discriminate against the size. We wanted to tag everything. We wanted to see if males would show up in certain locations and that kind of thing.
What kind of breakdown have you received gender-wise on return?
That's a good question, too, and I'm not sure I've ever looked for that. But I will definitely look for it when we get home. I don't know what the proportion is of males to females tagged, and I don't know what the proportion is of them recaptured. But I will look. Yeah, David.
The tags from Massachusetts returned to you from Massachusetts. I assume they were returned by fishermen.
Some were returned by observers.
Okay, so processors weren't returning tags.
That's correct.
Okay, because I was afraid that perhaps North Carolina tagged fish landed in North Carolina, were trucked to Massachusetts, the tags were found in Massachusetts, and the processors were returning the tags to you. So it looked like the Massachusetts recaptured, but they might have been North Carolina. So that's not a problem.
Okay, we do have that problem for Virginia, because some of the, you know, they're packed in Virginia, so or they used to be anyway, so. So I get occasionally some from packing houses in Virginia. And I've also gotten recaptures from Italy and France. And those, it's amazing. The commercial fishermen brought it on board, offloaded it, it was cut, and then it was shipped. And then some guy in Italy finds it in the box.
Are there any foreign vessels catching any of these tags? Or like Russian trawlers?
I haven't received any from them.
How does that return compared to other species?
When I was working on striped bass in the Bay of Fundy in the 80s and the early 90s, I got almost a 20% tag return rate. And that we were using the same tag. You know, the single barbed dart was the international orange, so I think that's a little bit more visible than these yellow ones. I do know that I've heard some commercial fishermen tell me they just throw my fish overboard. You know, they don't want anything to do with it. They don't even bother to take it out. But that really hurts, because then I get folks at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center saying, well, you know, you have to be careful about what your return rate is. You know, is it real? Is it 10% of the total that were really caught, or is it 50%? You know, what's the reporting rate here? It's 100%. It's always 100%. All those commercial fishermen send back those tags. But, you know, that doesn't happen either, you know. The truth is it's between 10% and 90% probably somewhere. So, but I would really, really encourage you guys
to go back to your commercial fishermen, to your state agency people, to your observers, and say it's really important to turn these tags in, because without your help, we just go dead in the water.
That's the word.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you. And I think another point is those tags, as Robert says, those tags are more valuable the longer they're acquired.
Yes.
Major growth. Do you get an increase in rewards?
No. You know, but every tenth tag that we put out is worth $50. And so, you know, the other ones are worth 10. So it's worthwhile. And it seems like the same few people are turning in tags, especially in Massachusetts. So I'm getting real good help from some people. And from others, you know, I'm not getting any help. So.
Thank you.